From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Lakers and the Celtics have begun what many hope will be yet another classic NBA final series. Ahead on Only a Game, an update from Kevin Hench. Also, Big Brown sprints round the final turn and toward the Triple Crown, but will he let everybody down? And will there be frowns? And the story of Dan Patch, the most famous racehorse of which you've probably never heard. Also ahead, stickball lovers and tough guys converge on the Bronx to compete and to reminisce.
When I hear about these professional baseball players, oh, he hurt his finger, give me a break. Used to play on top of the cars, under the cars, run into cars. Yeah, one time, stickball was illegal in Manhattan. Oh, yeah.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Depending upon how you feel about the spectacle that opened on Thursday night in Boston, it is either the finals of the 2008 NBA championship or it is the most recent chapter of a saga involving generations of professional basketball players and coaches, all of them connected to either the Lakers or the Celtics, some of them unquestionably gone and just as unquestionably not forgotten. Joining me now to discuss what's already happened in the NBA Finals and what's likely to happen next with perhaps the odd reference to Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill.
The Celtics defeated the Lakers 98-88 on Thursday night. They currently enjoy a one-games-to-none lead in the Finals. Did Game 1 live up to all that pregame hype?
I certainly think so. I mean, even the greatest moments of the early Celtic-Laker rivalry didn't involve a wheelchair, if I recall correctly. ABC and David Stern, I mean, Celtic fans must have been going crazy when they saw that. But imagine what David Stern and ABC were feeling as Paul Pierce was wheeled into the locker room. The series was momentarily over.
I agree. I mean, it's the juxtaposition of soap opera with sports. It doesn't get any better than that, I guess.
And, Bill, I know there's this debate as to whether or not Paul Pierce's Willis Reed performance was overrated or not. But I will say this for your older demographic. You know whose Willis Reed performance is overrated? Willis Reed's. He made two baskets in the game.
We're talking about 1970, of course, where Willis Reed made an appearance in his Knick uniform after everybody had written him off as too injured to ever play in that game, and he was an inspiration to his teammates.
He was an inspiration. Meanwhile, Walt Frazier was more than an inspiration with 36 points, 19 assists, and 5 steals, but you hardly ever hear about that because this guy limped onto the court and scored two baskets.
All right, so you're already comparing the great performances of players thought to be too injured to play. Where would you put Pierce on this list?
Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, if he has off-season surgery while the Celtics are carrying the trophy around New England, then we'll make it number one.
All right, I want to ask you about another particular regarding Game 1. Do we explain Kobe Bryant's shooting performance in Game 1 as an off night by Kobe Bryant or his great defense by the Celtics?
Well, it was his third consecutive off night against the Celtics. He's now on the season 24 for 72. That's 33% shooting. He didn't give the Celtics any credit for their defense after the game, saying that he just missed a bunch of open looks. I've watched the game three times now, and he didn't get a lot of good looks Thursday night. He may think he did, and that could be trouble for the Lakers because he was contested on almost every shot, especially down the stretch when he went 3 of 12 in the last 18 minutes, 52 seconds.
The NBA tends to promote its playoff series in a way that suggests that basketball is sort of a modern form of single combat, Kevin. But a Celtics-Lakers matchup is a good deal more than Kevin Garnett against Kobe Bryant, right?
Absolutely. And that's, I think, what we saw Thursday night was so much was made of the individual matchups and the problems the Celtics would have covering Kobe individually. But they have James Posey, Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett lurking nearby with that team defense that I called the Ricky Tikki Tavi defense, since Kobe has anointed himself the Black Mamba. If he's the snake, the Celtics are the mongoose, And in game one, the win went to the Mongoose for sure.
What do the coaches of these teams bring to the championship mix?
Well, Phil Jackson, I mean, they're both incredibly cool. Like, there is no hysteria on either bench. It's really refreshing. I think both coaches are great, and I think they have totally different styles. I think Phil is, you know, he's 6'9". He's a little stricter maybe. You know, he doesn't mind chastising his players, calling them out in the media, and then Doc gets by with just being a total, you know, sort of cheerleader, treating them like men, getting the most out of them by loving them, I think. So it's a little bit of a contrast, but I think they're both great coaches.
Footage of past Lakers-Celtics tilts has been prevalent, of course, on television. What are your favorite memories from 1984, 85, or the 87 finals?
I remember DJ going 12 for 12, Dennis Johnson, rest in peace, going 12 for 12 in the 1984 Game 7, ultra clutch. I remember, of course, the baby hook, Magic Johnson's baby hook. Who can forget Kevin McHale's clothesline of Kurt Rambis? All the moments. And, of course, the thing that is seared onto all of our retinas is the short shorts. There have been some gains made in the NBA, we have to admit.
Well, we don't have to watch players running around in their underwear any longer.
In fact, a lot of people have been pointing to the Celtics beating the Lakers in both games in the regular season, and I think you have to throw out the meeting in Los Angeles specifically because the Lakers went back to the short shorts. No modern player can play in those things.
We usually don't buy into conspiracy theories, but the truth must be told. Does NBA Commissioner David Stern really think he can get away with rigging the playoffs to ensure a Celtics-Lakers final and avoid, a series between the Raptors and the Nuggets or the Hawks and the Jazz?
Well, mission accomplished if he did it. I don't know if he's on the grassy knoll somewhere, but he certainly got what he wanted.
So which team has Commissioner Stern deemed worthy of possessing the highly coveted and very, very shiny Larry O'Brien trophy?
Well, if you consider the way he looked the other way when the Lakers acquired Pau Gasol for nothing, you'd have to think he's looking westward.
Is that your prediction as well, Kevin? Is that how you think it's going to turn out?
Yeah, I think the Lakers, you know, even though the Celtics won game one Thursday night, I thought the Lakers played pretty horribly and it was still a close game down the stretch. That's kind of a bad sign for the Celtics. Just watching the way the Lakers dismantled the Nuggets, Jazz, and Spurs, I think they're the best team right now. And usually in the NBA, the best team holds up the trophy at the end of the season. It's not like the Super Bowl where you can just play 60 great minutes and pull an upset. In the NBA Finals, it's the first team to four wins. I think that's going to be the Lakers.
Kevin Hench covers the NBA and many other letters in the alphabet soup of sports as well. Thanks very much, Kevin.
Thank you, Bill.
While the basketball world goes crazy over Big Ticket, Black Mamba, The Truth, The O-Dominator, and The Ghosts of Larry and Magic, one Lakers reserve is doing his best to shed light on one of the world's worst ongoing crises. From Los Angeles, Donnell Alexander reports.
33-year-old Lakers reserve Ira Neubel hasn't played a minute in the 2008 postseason. But the Detroit native is hoping to make a contribution that's bigger than any fourth-quarter bucket. He's trying to help Americans understand the current crisis in Darfur. Last summer, Neubel flew to Chad, right next door to the Darfur killing fields.
I wanted to be there and actually feel what was going on so that I could understand it and know what I was speaking about when I'm here in the States.
Given the choice, most steer clear of the Sudan's Janjaweed militia. Ira Neubel did not. He says he didn't know what to think when he arrived on an 8-seater prop plane. He was scared because the militia was only a couple of kilometers away. Soon, Neubel was listening to stories told by residents of a UNICEF camp in Chad near the Sudanese border.
I had to wait outside first because they wanted to make sure that the woman was comfortable because usually they don't want to speak about what happened to them in front of men. But they wanted me to hear so that I could tell their story. So I'm sitting in there and listening to a woman, and she says, the militia attacked her village, the planes drop bombs, and it smokes up the village. And then the Janjaweed ride in on horses and start killing, just murdering everybody that they can, men, women, children. And she said every single night she was raped by 10 to 20 men. And, you know, I'm you know, this is affecting me emotionally, but I'm trying to keep my composure just because of the strength that I see that she has just to be able to tell me the story.
Even the camp's children had horrific stories to share.
I walked into kind of like a crafts area for the kids to do things. They weren't sad or anything. They were having a good time. So I said, well, you know, let me see what you're drawing. I'm looking at stick figures of women running, holding babies with soldiers chasing them, AK-47s and automatic rifles and weapons, shooting them in the back as they're carrying a baby. There's red all over the paper because of the blood that they see. Every single picture was the same thing.
Neubel said those stories made him want to help. Last spring, a full year and a quarter before the start of the Beijing Olympics, Neubel, then a member of the Cleveland Cavaliers, approached his teammates.
Grouped them together and told them that there was something I was involved in. I had some information that I left in each player's locker, and I wanted them to read it. And then I have a letter I want them to sign, and, you know, if they have questions, we can discuss. You know, I'll talk about it, and we'll discuss what specifically is going on. And all the players read the information, and for the most part, they, without even asking me a question, they jumped on board and signed the letter. LeBron and Damon Johnson did not sign the letter. They were the only two players on my team that didn't sign the letter.
Cavaliers superstar LeBron James is sponsored by Nike. China is the source of much of that shoe company's labor. So Neubel was basically asking the NBA's biggest star to protest China's financial contributions to the Sudanese government.
LeBron's reason, he wanted more information and wanted to educate himself more about what was going on. And I respect his decision. We talked about it, and I respected that.
Ira stepped up to the plate. I actually heard my wife say that, and that's the wrong analogy for basketball. I'm sorry. But Ira just stepped up to, he took something on.
That's Hunter Payne of Aid Still Required, a nonprofit that offers assistance to people suffering in the aftermath of natural disasters and human crises. The group has benefited from associations with Kobe Bryant, Steve Nash, and Baron Davis since Ira Neubel committed to the Darfur cause.
Having 12 guys in your basketball team sign a letter about an issue that's that important in this day and age of athletes is really a remarkable thing to request of one player, let alone your entire team.
Recently, Neubel has generated support where once there was none.
The good part is LeBron has educated himself and he has stepped up and spoken out. And I'm pleased right now because that's what's happening. A lot of guys are getting involved. A lot of guys are speaking about it. Tracy McGrady played a big role. He went over there a month after I did.
Still, for all his outspokenness, Ira Neubel is taking a diplomatic approach to raising awareness about the Darfur crisis, particularly when it comes to the Beijing Summer Olympics.
I don't believe in a boycott because I wouldn't want to tell an athlete, you know, that's been dreaming about that to not be a part of an event, you know, on that magnitude. I believe that by going there, they can use that platform and use their voice while they're out there.
For Only a Game, I'm Donnell Alexander in Los Angeles.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Let there be no doubting the enthusiasm of Dr. Wei Shang for the 2008 Summer Olympics. Dr. Shang, who had already set an obscure world record by sticking 1,790 needles into his head, upped the ante in honor of the Beijing Games by sticking 2,008 needles into the same head from which he had removed the 1,790 needles. Not only that, Dr. Shang stuck needles decorated in the five colors of the Olympic rings into his hands and into his chest, thus thoroughly eclipsing the efforts of the Chinese man who had the symbol of the Olympics tattooed onto his forehead. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of the most famous horse ever to race without a jockey. But first, this afternoon, Big Brown will try to do what no horse has done in 30 years when, under the guidance of Kent DeSormo, he attempts to win in the Belmont Stakes and become the first Triple Crown winner since Affirmed. Joining me now to discuss the likelihood that it will happen is Jenny Reese, who covers thoroughbred racing for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Jenny, welcome back.
Always great to be here, Bill.
I don't know how important post position is when there are only, oh, 9 or 10 horses in a race, but Big Brown drew the rail. Would he and his people be happier further outside?
They would be, but it's better to have the best horse in the best post, and it's a 10-horse field, and you're not thinking that post position is going to matter. He has the most speed in the race, although another horse, Deterra, trained by Nick Zito, who has spoiled the Triple Crown bid in 2004, he thinks Deterra might also be out there, too. But I think, basically, Big Brown, he breaks fine, he's good in the gate, he's going to get in front, and it's just a question if he stays in front for a mile and a half. Kent DeSormo said, you know, the race might be over in 40 yards.
Kent DeSormo sounds a little bit like the fellow who trains that horse.
Well, I think it's rubbing off on him. They're all very confident. Of course, Kent knows how tough it can be to win a Triple Crown, as in 1998, he still has the demons of win on the last couple strides. Real Quiet, who looked like a Triple Crown winner, got nailed by another horse, Victory Gallop.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about 40 yards. It's the last 40 yards that might be the most important, not the first 40.
The odds makers obviously like Big Brown's chances. The second favorite is Casino Drive. And like Big Brown, Casino Drive is undefeated. But how significant is the designation undefeated when the horse has only run twice?
Well, it shows he's a very special horse that in his second career start, he came over from Japan, the first Japanese-based horse, although he's a Kentucky-born horse, but the first Japanese-based horse to run in the Belmont. He wins a Grade II race, the Peter Pan, with some ease by 5 3/4 lengths. So you're right. We don't have a real big line on him, and he hasn't gone against Big Brown, but these horses are getting more and more lightly raced. And even if you look at the third race, Dennis Accourt, he's only raced 5 times himself. Guadalcanal, a maiden trying to win, something only 3 other horses have done, win the Belmont when they hadn't won a previous race.
Mm-hmm.
He's only had 5. These horses are so lightly raced that the experience factor kind of gets diffused. Indeed, for all the talk we had when we started the whole Triple Crown campaign about how lightly raced Big Brown is, he seems like quite a grizzled, seasoned veteran at this point.
Several of the horses Big Brown beat in the Kentucky Derby skipped the Preakness, but they'll be back in the lineup this afternoon, a few of them anyway. Are their owners dreaming?
I think there's a horse that has a shot after very much study and deliberation. I think there's one horse that can beat Big Brown.
I'm ready.
Okay. I had to look at which horse could match Big Brown as far as how much fun we could have with puns in the headline.
Uh-huh.
And I've come up with Dennis of Cork.
Okay.
Dennis of Cork pops Brown's crown. Dennis the Menace to Big Brown. I think Charlie Pierce would be able to really have fun with this.
I hesitate even to think about the possibilities there. One of my favorite comments about this race came from trainer Bob Baffert, who said this week that jockey Kent DeSormo was getting, quote, a Triple Crown mulligan. He was referring to the fact that 10 years ago aboard Real Quiet, DeSormo did not win the Belmont Stakes. When doing so, would have won the Triple Crown for Baffert, of course. Is Baffert rooting for DeSormo this time around?
I think he is. They were talking about how he came by the barn to meet Big Brown, and I think he's rooting for the sport. He doesn't have a horse in here. I think he would love to see the sport have a Triple Crown winner. But here's my take on Real Quiet in 1998. He just wasn't good enough. There's no flukes in the Triple Crown, and you don't have to apologize if you do win, and he just was a couple of inches shy of being good enough, but he wasn't.
Big Brown's trainer, Rick Dutrow, has said that he feels the result of the Belmont is, and I'm quoting now, a foregone conclusion. Jenny, I'm sure lots of trainers may have felt that way about their horses in various races, but how many of them would say it?
Rick Dutrow? That's the only one. I asked Billy Turner, what's the most confident expression you ever had with Slew? And he said, I never said anything like that. And he had one of the all-time great horses in Seattle, Slew. There's a common thought that the racing gods won't let Rick Dutrow win because of this. You just don't say that. You tempt them, and they get mad at you when you do that. But, you know, they didn't have an issue with it for the Derby or the Preakness. So here we are, unless they're trying to just, the racing gods are just trying to set him up for a big fall.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time he took a big fall. Lots of people have sort of looked into Mr. Dutrow's history and asked him about that, and I guess he's kind of tired of talking about various arrests and other problems in his past.
I'm sure he is, and he's been a good sport about it, but the way you deal with that is if you just don't make the infractions and nobody asks you about them. He does have a lot of bad paper behind him, both substances, prohibitive substances that maybe have ended up in his horse's system and maybe have ended up in his own system. And then there's some other things, too. I think he's a brilliant horseman, but he does have a history of not following the rules.
Okay, Jenny, you mentioned Dennis of Cork, and I'm not sure whether you think that was because you think Dennis of Cork can really finish first, or you just like playing games with the various verbal possibilities involved with him. But it's time for you to give our grateful listeners Big Brown again, as in the Preakness, or perhaps some other horse, you tell me.
I actually really do like Dennis of Cork. He was a horse when I was changing my top pick in the Derby pool, like about every week, to wear an owner of one horse that accused me of the flavor of the week. He was my flavor 1 week after he won the Southwest to go to 3 for 3. And he got off schedule. They, you know, switched his schedule around, and he ran poorly in the Illinois Derby, but ran a very nice race in the Kentucky Derby to come from last to finish third. And while he did get beat 8 1/4 lengths, I think he's really going to improve off that. He's got a horse that just sort of has the look of a distance horse. And I think, besides just being a contrarian, he's 12-1 in the line, that he offers really good value. And also, you know, if I pick Big Brown, he probably has no shot of winning. So I got to go in another direction.
Jenny Reese writes about horse racing for the Louisville Courier-Journal, and she has never missed when picking winners for Only a Game. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thanks, Jenny.
You got to do something about those podcasts, though, if we want to stick to that story, I'm afraid, though, Bill.
If you're interested in listening at your leisure to Only a Game, to my weekly commentary, or to longer versions of my conversations with authors, athletes, and experts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. Like to see some stuck-up jockey boy sitting on Dan Patch? Make your blood boil, I should say. So spoke Harold Hill, the flim-flamming music man of the musical comedy of the same name. A jockey boy, stuck-up or not, would have been superfluous on Dan Patch. The horse pulled a sulky. He was a pacer, and not just a pacer, but the beloved and famous pacer that set records and won hearts at every stop on the Grand Circuit during the days when the country was much younger and the pacers and trotters, rather than the thoroughbreds, were kings. In Crazy Good, subtitled The True Story of Dan Patch, the Most Famous Horse in America, Charles Learson tells the story of that horse. He joins me now from NPR's New York studios. Charles, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
In this time of lots of books about accomplished horses, you had a challenge in writing about Dan Patch. When you started thinking about telling this story, how many of the people to whom you spoke even knew that there had been a horse called Dan Patch?
Oh, how true. I tell people that I had kind of a reverse Dale Carnegie course experience when I was writing this book, which, you know, the Dale Carnegie course is a lot about getting people to like you and appreciate yourself. I say, I'm writing a book, and they'd say, what's it about? And I'd say, Dan Patch. And then they would feel very bad because they'd never heard of the horse. And I'd touched this point with often very intelligent people and I'd found something they didn't know about. And they felt bad for a few seconds. And then they sort of felt like displeased with me and angry with me. Mm. And they made some wild guesses as to who he was. Some people thought he was an old ball player. The name has a kind of a maybe turn of the 20th century sound to it. And then one person said to me, isn't that a name for the devil? And I think he had him confused with Old Scratch. I had to look that up.
Though Dan Patch is the star of your story, Crazy Good is full of intriguing two-legged characters as well. Myron McHenry, perhaps foremost among them. Of Mr. McHenry, the man who drove Dan Patch, you write, apart from the money to be made, he found the idea of hoodwinking the public irresistible. Tell me more of Myron McHenry.
This was a mean, cranky man, beyond cranky. He was a superstar of his day, and he's kind of a parallel figure to Dan Patch. Everyone knew who Myron McHenry was. He was the best sulky driver, harness racing driver, of his day. And like Dan Patch, he's been completely forgotten. He was a hard liver, a drinker and a womanizer and, had probably other faults, too. And he did. He set up a few fixed races, as we describe in the book. But He was known as the Wizard of the Home Stretch. Everyone had a nickname, or some people had like seven nicknames in those days. And he was a figure of great fascination, but he had almost no horses in his stable at any one time because he was so mean, and because he also like hit on the wives of the owners of the horses, and he would eventually lose these horses. So his career is a story of great horses slipping through his fingers, and that's what happened actually with Dan Patch also.
You write that the grand circuit upon which Dan Patch performed was intriguingly impure, as all horse racing has always been. But is it fair to say that Dan Patch brought a kind of purity to the game?
Well, he did, Bill. He raced against other horses, of course, in the beginning of his career, and then he ran out of competition. And then he went on to race against the clock. Racing was so crooked in those days that people appreciated it. It was like a no-nonsense, hey, it's either he beats the clock or he doesn't. and no fooling around. And you could bet on that. But in those days, they had heat racing, like best three out of four or two out of three. And that allowed so many opportunities. You could still win the race, but you could lose an individual heat. So these guys really fooled around. And because if you lost a heat with a horse like Dan Patch, and this actually happened twice with Dan Patch, he was stiffed, you could then introduce a little bit of doubt as to whether the horse was really up to it and get higher odds in the subsequent heat while cashing a bet on another horse in the heat in which you hold Dan Patch back in, if you follow that. So there was a lot of fooling around in those days, and people both took it as part of the game but didn't like it at the same time.
Perhaps even more remarkable than his speed and his record on the track against other horses was Dan Patch's disposition. He was gentle, especially with children, and when the crowd cheered, he bowed in recognition. Or did you make that up?
I didn't. I mean, not only didn't I make it up, but his trainer never taught him to do that. The old cantankerous, cranky Myron McHenry, that's the last thing he would do is bring a horse back and have him bow nicely before the crowd. He'd bring him back and spit at the crowd, maybe. But Dan Patch wanted to do this. Whenever he saw a photographer, a guy aiming a camera at him, he stopped. He got the idea of the superstar thing, and he liked it. You know, he had this quality that it comes down to, I think, is trust. He trusted humans, and human beings appreciated him for that and loved him. He didn't worry unnecessarily like a lot of horses do, and it's understandable. They don't know what's going to happen next. But Dan Patch just took everything in stride, and as you mentioned, he was very gentle. Children used to run back and forth beneath his stomach. When he got back home in Minnesota in the off season, he would pull kids on his sleigh around town. Kind of a remarkable thing. You won't see Big Brown doing that in the bluegrass country.
Dan Patch inspired at least two musical compositions and also what you have called the worst poem ever written. I wonder if you would be so kind as to recite that poem.
Well, this is from the Horse Review, which was a magazine that came out weekly in those days. I'll see if I can do it justice. This was after one of his big wins, after he set the world record once again. "We hail thee, proud monarch of the turf, and yield to thee thy laurels fairly won. Dauntless is thy courage, matchless is thy worth. By thee all kings before thee are undone." It's pretty horrible.
Hey, if it's not the worst, it's among them, as they say.
But there were either other poems about him in the Horse Review that kind of mixed black dialect with Irish dialect. It was just awful. So people couldn't control themselves when it came to Dan Patch.
I'm talking with Charles Learson, the author of Crazy Good, The True Story of Dan Patch, the Most Famous Horse in America. You're listening to Only a Game. Dan Patch died on July 11th, 1916. How did the world of harness racing and the world beyond harness racing respond?
Well, it's funny. He'd been so popular. He made $1 million a year endorsing products. This is at a time when Ty Cobb, the highest paid baseball player, was making $12,000 a year. But by the time he died, and he lived to be 20, which is not an extraordinarily old age for a horse, but the world had changed. The automobile had arrived, and the horse that was so beloved, even as he was a practical everyday thing, became old-fashioned. And people turned away from horses. And when Dan Patch finally died, he his death didn't make big headlines, I found. And it's kind of poignant and sad. And he was on his way to being forgotten even while he was alive, because he represented a kind of technology which had been superseded by the automobile.
In your subtitle, you identify Dan Patch as the most famous horse in America, but I wonder how many of our listeners could name a single trotter or pacer today. What's happened to the sport Dan Patch dominated?
Well, one answer is the automobile. I mean, that's what really, when harness racing was the number one sport in the country, it was kind of like NASCAR, because people would go out and they would root for horses that maybe were genetically, you know, related to the horses they had in their own stable at home. And so it was kind of like NASCAR. So the car was one thing that undid harness racing. Then some people maybe remember that harness racing had a big renaissance after World War II, when it became a nighttime game that fit very well with the new era of prosperity and lots of leisure time and the moves to the suburbs. What killed that eventually was a combination of things, the spread of casino gambling and whatnot. So harness racing has had a couple of high points, and now it's, I don't know if you could say it's on its last legs, but it's almost back where it was in the days just before Dan Patch, when it was just a country fair sport.
Charles Learson is the author of Crazy Good, The True Story of Dan Patch, the Most Famous Horse in America, published by Simon & Schuster. He joined me from the NPR studios in New York. Charles, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
And listen to some big out-of-town Jasper hearing him talk about horse race gambling. Not a wholesome trotting race, no, but a race where they sit down right on a horse. I'd like to see some stuck-up jockey boy sitting on Dan Patch, make your blood boil, well, I should say. Now, friends, let me tell you what I mean. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pockets in the table. Pockets that mark the difference between a gentleman and a bum, with a capital B, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. And all week long, your River City youth will be frittering away. I say your young men will be frittering.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Running back Noah Herron wasn't of much use to the Green Bay Packers last season. He was out with a knee injury, but the would-be burglar who entered Herron's home late last Friday night was mistaken if he assumed that a year on the disabled list had rendered Herron an easy target for burgling. Having heard noise on the first floor of his house, Herron unscrewed a bedpost, and when the intruder entered his bedroom, the running back demonstrated an aptitude for baseball. After the intruder had been taken to the hospital, a spokesman for the Green Bay Police said Noah Herron had used necessary, reasonable, and justifiable force in protecting his life and property.
What can you do? What can you do? With a brand like that, though, it's on your mom. What can you lose? What can you do? What can you do?
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a look at the game Willie Mays used to play after work. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Big Brown, once again, a prohibitive favorite, prohibitive enough so that you are not going to go with him?
Well, I'm not going to try to say prohibitive more than once because
easy.
I probably can't do it. But yes, I think there is absolutely no way for anyone to make money on the Belmont Stakes. I will, for the second choice, I will stay with Dennis of Cork, who I picked in the Kentucky Derby. And if you want to look for someone to make a little bit money on down the ticket, just to say you bought a ticket on a race where somebody won the Triple Crown, Guadalcanal, who was a late entry, who ran a mile and a half at Churchill Downs and did pretty well, what might be worth a bob or two, as the Brits say, but not no more than two bob.
We have our finalists in the French Open, so
oh,
do you
boy.
Care now?
Oh, boy! Who are they?
On I'm the sorry. Men's side, the usual suspects on the men's side, Mr. Nadal, the master of that particular surface, is once again showing up for work.
Good for him. Uh-huh. They should. That doesn't matter. They should still be holding this in a big tent next to the Ferris wheel with a guy behind a podium saying, "Step right up. This thing is the three-headed goat boy of professional sports,
right.
And always will be."
Let us move along
to a sport
that I know that you consider utterly and completely legitimate. What, if anything, did Game 1 of the NBA Finals tell us about how that series between the Celtics and the Lakers will play out?
Well, I'm very glad they don't play basketball on clay, by the way, or else you might see two teams you've never heard of win. Basically, it showed that if the game is played under the triple digits, even if it's only 2 points under the triple digits, the Celtics will likely win, which leads me to question the overwhelming consensus of national people who have picked the Lakers. Sometimes the ball doesn't go in, but if you can really play defense, you can always decide to really play defense, and you can change a game with it, and that's what they did. They held the Lakers to under 40 points in the second half.
The Detroit Red Wings are once more champions of the National Hockey League. At least one commentator called Detroit's style during the finals against the Pittsburgh Penguins, quote, grimly methodical. Is that an accurate characterization?
I don't imagine the Red Wings care very much, but yes, it is. It's not as ugly and awful. It was not as ugly and awful as the New Jersey Devils were a few years ago, but it was not the kind of slam-bang flying up and down the ice hockey guaranteed to get TV ratings.
I maybe didn't pay enough attention to the finals in the National Hockey League, but I thought the new rules had been designed to discourage grimly methodical in favor of exciting.
No, they were designed to eliminate grimly unwatchable. Hmm. Grimly methodical is still well within the bounds of the rules, yes.
Charlie, on Thursday, convicted steroids dealer David Jacobs and his acquaintance Amanda Jo Earhart Savelle were found dead in Jacobs' Plano, Texas home. Jacobs had met with NFL security personnel just a couple of weeks ago and allegedly offered information about NFL players who had purchased steroids from him. Are we looking at the beginning of the next big sports steroid scandal here?
I think we are, and I think the stakes have obviously been raised considerably. He was apparently quite open with a lot of people that the information he had people might well kill for. And as the investigation goes along, I'd be very interested to see what happens here.
Braves slugger Chipper Jones hit his 400th homer this week, and he's hitting over 400 with his batting average. Come fall, what do we see? Our first 400 hitter in God knows how long since Ted Williams?
Well, it's the imbalance in batting averages in the American and National Leagues is just astonishing this year. The National League pitching is just dreadful. So, yeah, I think you might well, I think you'll see a 400 chase go at least past the All-Star break, which we haven't had for a while. But, yes, I think it's entirely possible we might have the incredible 400 circus open up right around the beginning of August.
The Minnesota Twins have bobbed up toward the top of the American League Central Division, and I guess that's not the only reason Minnesota fans have been smiling recently, even as the rest of us have been digging through garages and basements for our bicycles.
They're going to take the current national average cost for a gallon of unleaded regular, which is around $3.95 or $4 right now, and they're going to deduct that from the price of each upper club and lower reserve ticket. So I guess there are silver linings to anything. The question is, of course, how do you get to the ballpark?
The members of the International Olympic Committee have apparently received some great gifts from people in Tokyo, Madrid, Rio de Janeiro, and Chicago. Those cities are the finalists in the competition to host the Summer Games in 2016. Are you shocked that Baku, Azerbaijan, didn't make the most recent cut?
I am absolutely, positively desolate that Baku didn't make the final cut. By the way, the choice of the remaining cities has got to be Rio.
I would think.
I mean, certainly not Chicago. People in Chicago, get a grip. You do not want this thing in your town under no circumstances. But, of course, I am personally happy that nobody will be sentenced, as I was once in my life, to 13 days in Doha, Qatar. Because let me tell you, that thing is an aircraft carrier with a flag and a seat at the UN. I would rather be a lamppost in Baku than the mayor of Doha.
Something I probably shouldn't laugh at, but there I've done it again. And finally, we turn to Japan, where regional heats are underway in a competition that, well, is it fair to characterize it as the antithesis of ultimate martial arts?
Hang on, Bill. Entertain our readers while I read this story again, because it makes absolutely no sense to me.
We'll stop.
Poetry boxing,
mm-hmm.
Which is you get two people in the ring, and they read poems to each other, and they have red and blue corners, and the subject matter can be almost anything. And they're permitted to use props, but not on each other. You can use props, and they score the poems that score the highest rely on the words, the voice, and delivery. Now, I remember the three or four bouts that Yates and W.H. Auden used to fight? Those were freaking bloodbaths. I'm glad this sport is coming by.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
The center cannot hold, and if it does, I'll hit you right where it counts, pal.
In my conversation with Charlie Pierce 2 weeks ago, Charlie acknowledged that he had not only watched the Champions League final between Manchester United and Chelsea, he had enjoyed it. Given Charlie's customary dismissal of soccer, I asked one of the producers here to make a call to see if hell had frozen over. Save your dime, wrote George Vigliarolo, a WBUR listener. The ninth and final circle of hell is a frozen lake. Dante was there, and he ought to know. Do hosts of AM sports talk shows get emails like that? Rhetorical question. But when I chatted with the proprietor of a blog called TheDirty.com on the show last week, one listener compared us to our AM counterparts. Kudos for taking on a relevant subject, wrote WHRV listener Carrie Davis Murphy, but huge brickbats for letting your discussion disintegrate into the kind of snarky sniping that made me turn off the show. The self-justifying posturing of your two guests is exactly why I don't listen to most sports opinion shows. Usually I can count on Only a Game to be a refuge from that sort of hot air. Please, please, please say this was a rare misstep. Chris Ward Garrison wrote this week to say thanks for including the topic of tennis on your show. Our brief examination of the state of men's tennis in the U.S. led Mr. or Ms. Garrison to write, I would be surprised if most people care about tennis players' countries of origin, and out of this whole wide world of tennis players and fans, only John McEnroe would suggest a John McEnroe tennis center. Neil Roundtree, who hears Only a Game on KBSU in Boise, Idaho, was irked that the author with whom I spoke last week, Franz Lids, called his collection of essays about golf Fairway to Hell, since Mr. Lids had encountered the rock group Judas Priest on said fairway, not the members of AC/DC, the group responsible for the song Highway to Hell. That's another sort of email hosts of AM talk radio probably don't get. And finally, Joe Busa, a WBUR listener, wrote, would you please ask Tim Kirkjian not to use the word demonstrably so often? If I were a professional commentator, I would try not to use the same word so often that it became a distraction and an irritant. Should you wish to send an email to Only a Game, you can easily do so by visiting onlyagame.org and clicking on Send Us an Email. That makes a certain amount of sense. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can also write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Every year, stickball players from New York, California, Puerto Rico, and Florida gather in the Bronx for a tournament called the Memorial Day Classic. Only a Game's John Kalish was on hand as 14 teams from around the country whacked pink rubber balls great distances on Stickball Boulevard.
There really is a Stickball Boulevard. It's in the Soundview section of the Bronx, and during much of the Memorial Day weekend, two stickball games were played simultaneously on a stretch that runs between an elementary school and an athletic field. There were also two games played simultaneously at a nearby tennis court where you could still hear the high-decibel salsa music that permeated the weekend, even though the sound system was a block away. Albert Colon, a plumber with a shaved head who was dressed in black tank top and slacks, was coaching the Royals in a game against another team known as the STEM.
I've been coming to these tournaments for the last 15 years. It's a lot of fun. It's all family-oriented. When you start meeting everybody from the Bronx, and then you have teams from San Diego, from Puerto Rico, from Florida, it's like a big family reunion every year. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, if your family happens to be named Hatfield or McCoy, Colon was refereeing a game between two Bronx rivals, the Emperors and the Gold, when an argument arose over a line drive down the third baseline. This fracas, which was eventually decided in favor of the gold, lasted 10 minutes. Apparently, arguments over disputed plays can go on for as long as 20 minutes. Stickball diehards in the 21st century will tell you that this tournament is the place to come and prove yourself, and that the Bronx has some of the best stickball teams in these United States. The Bronx also excels at the rich tradition of razzing. Jennifer LaPolt, a photography teacher at Lehman High School in the Bronx, is the manager of the STEM, which got its name by spelling Mets backwards. During the game between the STEM and the Royals, LaPolt and her players were really giving it to the Royals when they came to bat. But, says LaPolt,
this is part of the game. You cannot come to Stickball Boulevard without talking trash. And if you attempt to play in this game, you got to dish it, you got to accept it, and you got to get used to it. Because when you're up there batting and everyone's talking to you, trust me, if you're not used to it, you're going to do something embarrassing. So you might as well give out the talk as well and be part of the whole game.
You'll notice it's mainly the East Coast teams that do that.
Tom Navarro plays with the Young Stars, a stickball team from San Diego.
They'll find something about you, and they'll hammer it down. The West Coast teams, generally, they don't normally do that. We'll just play a quiet game and just play. And then whenever something comes up, we'll make fun of it, but nothing like what these guys do out here.
Many of the players and most of the fans that turned out for the Memorial Day weekend stickball tournament were Puerto Rican. Since the tournament's inception 23 years ago, teams have popped up all over the country, many of them started by former New Yorkers. Richard Marrero is president of the Bronx-based New York Emperors Stickball League.
Stickball League, they started in California and Puerto Rico and in Florida. Well, guys that were raised in the Bronx and migrated out there. They played here every Memorial Day, so went out there and started teaching the kids out there.
Bobby Medina is a son of the Bronx who now coaches one of Florida's seven stickball teams, the Miami Hurricanes. By the way, there's also a Stickball Boulevard in North Miami.
I'm originally a New Yorker. I live just a few blocks from here on Bolton Avenue. I used to play stickball here in the Bronx. I used to play a different version. I used to play the fast pitch, pitching in against the wall at Public School 69, just up the street on Soundview.
In the fast pitch version of stickball, the batter stands in front of a wall so there's no catcher. If the batter swings and misses, the ball hits the wall and bounces back to the pitcher. At the Bronx tournament, they play self-pitch or fungo-style stickball, in which the batter tosses the ball in the air and lets it bounce once or twice before swinging. Some of the old-timers at the tournament remembered when stickball was played with pitching but no wall, sometimes with one-bounce pitching. Joe Conzo played stickball growing up in Harlem.
Different boroughs played it different ways. I think Brooklyn, certain parts of Brooklyn, played pitching in. In Harlem, they played on one bounce. That's the only way that most people that grew up in the 30s, the 40s, and 50s know how to play stickball. When you pitch it in, it's harder. It's like a baseball game. You know, you don't swing at the first. Take your time. You wait for the right pitch. It takes longer, though. You know, it was a longer game.
At the stickball tournament in the Bronx, teams fielded eight players. There's no catcher or pitcher. There are a few other differences between stickball and baseball. Again, Richard Marrero.
You get one swing. There's no four balls, three strikes. It's just one swing. If you don't hit it, if you foul tip it, you foul ball, you're out. And also, we don't use gloves. You use your bare hands. Some guys hit this ball, they could be doing 100 miles an hour, and guys catch with one hand.
Because you only get that one swing, if you miss it, your turn at bat is over. Tom Navarro of the Young Stars of San Diego knows what it's like to be embarrassed on Stickball Boulevard.
It's pretty embarrassing, especially when it comes down to pressure and you have a runner in scoring position. You come up, big whiff. It's like all eyes are on you, and all you can do is just have your head down. I'd much rather foul out than whiff the ball. And I whiffed a lot this tournament, so unfortunately, like I said, I couldn't find my bounce.
Before the tournaments and fenced-off streets such as Stickball Boulevard here in the Bronx, the sport had an outlaw element to it. Again, old-timer Joe Conzo.
When I hear about these professional baseball players, oh, he hurt his finger, he hurt the... Give me a break. It's to play on top of the cars, under the cars, run into cars. Yeah, one time, stickball was illegal in Manhattan. Oh, yeah. We always had to have somebody watching out for the cops. And hide the bats, throw them under the cars and everything. The cops used to bust our chops in the 40s and 50s. And then, of course, our mothers would bust our chops, too, because they would lose broomsticks and mop sticks.
This year's stickball tournament in the Bronx was won by the Gold in a 19-2 rout over the Whompers of San Diego. In what can only be called an asphalt humiliation, the Gold scored 13 runs in one inning. The Whompers will get a chance for revenge during the Labor Day stickball tournament in San Diego. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Jim Doyle and from Doug Trabu. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories, past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from the members of Bronx stickball rivals, the Gold and the Emperor.
Oh! Wild ball! Wild ball!
Let's hope that rhubarb, which began on Memorial Day weekend, gets resolved by Labor Day. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.